This is the 17th annual C.S. Lewis Lecture at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. The speaker is Dr. Dallas Willard of the University of Southern California. Dr. Willard wrote In Search of Guidance, The Spirit of the Disciplines, and most recently, The Divine Conspiracy. The lecture took place at the university April 12, 1999.
A little bit different surroundings from our usual place of gathering. I believe the musicians got to the Hayes Auditorium before we did this year. But we're happy to have you here, and it is certainly, as you can see, a colorful place for us to be. Before we do anything else, it is appropriate for us to begin the evening by saying thanks to a number of people. Thanks to InterVarsity Christian Fellowship for conceiving of this event in 1983. Thanks to the Collegiate Christian Fellowship and all of the campus ministries here for their sponsorship of the event. Thanks to Benwood Foundation, Chattanooga Christian Community Foundation, the Speakers and Special Events Committee of the University, all for financial support in making the event possible. We owe them all a debt of gratitude. This evening's speaker is Dr. Dallas Willard, who is a native of Missouri. And my wife gets on me when I use that pronunciation, but he used it.
That's right.
I asked him about his place of birth, so I feel justified. But actually came to Chattanooga, to Tennessee Temple, for his first college degree, studying psychology here, and then going on to Baylor University for a degree in philosophy, and to the University of Wisconsin for his doctorate in philosophy. He then went to California, which I believe I recall he said a little early in the evening was the major shift of fault lines for him, adjustment. But it was an adjustment that obviously took because he has had his academic career at the University of Southern California since 1965. There have been teaching stints at UCLA, at Colorado, and in Italy. But his home has been at USC, famed for tailbacks otherwise. He is a professor of philosophy, and he has interests that range widely, but they link up logic and a mathematical basis for philosophy with a strong and professional interest in ethics. In his career at USC, Dr. Willard has been the recipient of numerous teaching awards, including that of an outstanding faculty member nominated and named by the Student Senate. Dr. Willard is the author of a number of books. For our purposes, we'll focus on a trilogy, The Spirit of the Disciplines, In Search of Guidance, and The Divine Conspiracy, a series of books that deal with the spiritual condition of mankind. The most recent of these, The Divine Conspiracy, is one in which he says he has constructed in order to give a fresh hearing for Jesus. And it begins with, and I will conclude my introduction and make the transition to our evening speaker, it begins with a very graphic image that is offered as an expression of the moral condition, an intellectual condition in which modern humanity often finds itself. Recently, writes Dr. Willard, a pilot was practicing high-speed maneuvers in a jet fighter. She turned to the controls for what she thought was a steep ascent and flew straight into the ground. She was unaware that she had been flying upside down. Dr. Dallas Willard.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. It's great to be back in Chattanooga. Last time I was on this campus, it was the University of Chattanooga, and I was studying analytic geometry. And it was a wonderful time to be here. Obviously, things have changed and moved on in many respects. Now, this evening, I'm going to talk to you about a rather philosophical issue. Sometimes we don't know, or we've forgotten, that C.S. Lewis was actually trained as a philosopher, and indeed for a while practiced as a philosopher in Magdalen College in Oxford. And the topic that we're addressing tonight is one that centers on a very specific issue, and that is the subjectivity of values. Lewis's view was that the belief in the subjectivity of values would lead to the destruction of civilization, which he called the abolition of man. And so this evening, the topic is a little daring, perhaps, refashioning education. Titles are titles. And I will be talking about a very specific point in the issue of education. But C.S. Lewis and the Abolition of Man, the book The Abolition of Man, is directed towards a failure to understand values that he thought would lead through the structuring of education in the wrong way to the destruction of civilization as he knew it. All of that, I think, is very grandiose and interesting, but I'm afraid I'm going to be more focused than that this evening, because I'd like for us to go away from this place with some different grasp on the issue of the subjectivity of values, and perhaps with some ideas about how we might respond to it in our culture, which in so many ways has fulfilled Lewis's expectation. I understand I have about 45 or so minutes to talk this evening, and then we'll have some questions, so I encourage you, please, to write down your criticisms and your questions or your comments, and hopefully we'll have time to work a number of those in this evening. Lewis begins his discussion in The Abolition of Man with comments on a book which he calls The Green Book. The Green Book is actually an essay at a sort of middle level, middle school level, for training people to understand how literature and language works. And The Green Book starts out with a story drawn from the life of Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Coleridge was visiting a waterfall on a tourist trip, and as he stood looking at the waterfall, he heard two people discussing it over here to the side, two other tourists. And one of them said that the waterfall was sublime. So hold on to that word, sublime, if you would, for a moment. That the waterfall was sublime. And the other tourist said that it was pretty. And Coleridge fell into something of a snit over this. And he was, I think he uses the word disgusted, with the person who said that the waterfall was pretty. Thought that sublimity was objectively different from pretty, and that the person who said the waterfall was pretty had missed the point. Now, this is the starting point for The Green Book. The Green Book, by the way, actually exists. It is a real book. You can see it if you go to the Lewis Archives in Wheaton. They'll show it to you. And it was a book that was used in the schools. And The Green Book takes the point of view that pretty is no different than sublime. That there is no objective difference between something that is pretty and something that is sublime. Because both only indicate a feeling in the mind of the speaker. Both are simply a response that the viewer might have. And there is no such thing as sublimity in reality. Of course, there's no such thing as pretty either, right? Pretty also. And the point is intended to apply to all judgments or predicates, as the language Lewis uses, has predicates of value. So it would not just apply to a waterfall. For example, it would apply, suppose you wanted to say that the last movement of Beethoven's fourth piano concerto is sublime. You might want to refer to some pieces of poetry, perhaps an elegy of some sort, as having a quality of the sublime to it. So sublimity is a general quality of value that applies to many kinds of things. But of course, Lewis was not just interested in that particular kind of quality, which you might call an aesthetic value. He was more interested than, even in that, more interested in moral predicates. A good person, a venerable person, an act that was honorable, a belief that was charitable, and so on. So all of these terms now are that's the range that Lewis is aimed at. Lewis says on page 15 of the Abolition of Man in its current paperback edition, he says, quote, "The schoolboy who reads this passage in the Green Book will believe two propositions. Firstly, that all sentences containing a predicate of value are statements about the emotional state of the speaker. And secondly, that all such statements are unimportant." All such statements are unimportant. Now, the effect of this is to banish judgments of value from the realm of objective matters of fact. And that's what Lewis is really concerned about in the book. And as I shall explain in more detail in just a moment, that's what he believes will lead to the abolition of man. The dismissal of judgments of value from the area of objective matters of fact. Now, before you dismiss it, the importance of that too quickly, you want to think of some polling results that come from studies of American society. George Gallup, in one of his polls, has given a statistic that is often quoted, especially in Christian circles. And according to that statistic, 65% of people who believe that the Bible is the Word of God do not believe in absolute truth. If you haven't heard that before, you need to sort of let that your mind marinate in that thought and ask yourself, how could this be? And certainly, we don't mean to suggest that you have to be closed-minded and dogmatic in your approach to the Bible or religion. Absolute truth is not the same thing as dogmatism and closed-mindedness. To speak of absolute truth is merely to say that something is true independently of what people may think or feel about it. How could that be? Really, it is precisely the consequences of the teaching of the Green Book. And Lewis was highly prophetic when he suggested that there were serious consequences. And we will go into that more in a moment. Why is this view in general accepted? Why have we come, and it would be nice if we had time perhaps to sketch the history of the development, which has taken about three centuries at a minimum, to come up to the end of this century in the form it now has. But really, there are basically two reasons why people accept the view that not only sublimity, but other values are not objective matters of fact. And one is, it is thought to be true today that values cannot be dealt with by science, and that science deals with the physical world, and that the physical world is what is real. And in the physical world, there's no room for properties such as sublimity. There is no room for properties such as honorable, as it might apply to an action or a person, or for that matter, dishonorable. Negative predicates are in just as much trouble as the positive ones. And a great deal of that is based upon this idea that the world is a physical reality, and in that world there are no values. And how do we know that? Because physics and its offspring cannot deal and do not deal with values. For example, you could not take some kind of meter, let's say a sublimity meter, and hold it up before the waterfall and see how much it registered. Right? There's no meter, there's no physical test for the sublimity of the waterfall. And so if one has bought into the view that the world as dealt with by science is the world that is real, then there's no sublimity in the real world, and none of the other values as well. Lewis was very conscious of this, and I see that one of your, I think the second from the last lecture in your series, was on the topic of scientism and Lewis's approach to that. And scientism is simply the view that science is the measure of knowledge and reality, and anything that is not dealt with by science is not real and not knowable. So that's one of the reasons why this view has come to be accepted. Very slowly, because the fundamentals of the view have been around since the 1700s, but very slowly it has pervaded culture, and especially after the Second World War, has captured the popular mind. The second reason is not unrelated to the first. The second reason why this view of the Green Book is accepted is because of the fact that value predicates are not equally graspable by everyone. If you wish to appreciate the sublimity of a waterfall, you have to have certain abilities and certain interests, perhaps certain concepts, sensitivities, perhaps even some character of your vision. Obviously, you'd have to have vision that was good enough to see the waterfall in order to grasp its sublimity. And this has troubled many people. Same thing is true of, well, suppose you wanted to have an argument about whether or not a Beethoven quintet was a greater piece of music as such than a song by Bruce Springsteen. Now, one way of doing that is say, let's vote. Right? Let's say I incline an Ockmusik over against Born in the USA. And it'd be a very American thing to do, just vote. Because after all, we're all equal, aren't we? And so one might think that if voting is the way to decide it, we'd just go on the opinions of people and take whatever came out of it. Well, I think in this place, very few people would be prepared to take that route. And I doubt that many of you would be prepared to say, well, if it turns out that 51% of the people vote that Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA is a greater piece of music than Ein Kleiner Nachtmusik, it is. And why? Well, I think that's because most of you will agree that not everyone has equal knowledge of music. and that indeed you need to have some knowledge to be able to make a judgment. Now, interestingly enough, it's precisely this variability of judgments that leads many people to think that the properties judged about are not objective. And I think a lot of the social and political impetus of egalitarianism has led people to draw the conclusion of the Green Book. And so I'm hoping you see that there are really two main reasons why someone might draw the conclusion of the Green Book and advance the position that Lewis is concerned about. And these are, as I've said, that one, sublimity is not scientific. Two, it is not equally graspable by everyone. And those arguments are taken very seriously, and they lead to the position which Lewis characterizes, where values are passed off as simply subjective responses and not objective realities. And therefore, when we make decisions of value, we have nothing to go on but the force and power of the persons who make the judgments. And we're going to come back to that in a moment and talk about the reasoning on the other side. But for now, let's think a little bit about why Lewis says that this leads to the abolition of man. This program of purification, which the Green Book is on, Lewis refers to as the debunking of values. And Lewis is concerned that if we accept that, then a reasoned understanding of values will disappear from human life. And he spends a great deal of time talking about the effect that this will have. In particular, he has a long discussion about how human beings think of themselves as mastering nature. And in the course of mastering nature, mastering human nature. Determining how the course of life will go among human beings. Decision itself then becomes something that is only guided by power and impulse or force. Human decisions about other human beings are guided only by impulse, power, and force. And on page 84 of The Abolition of Man, Lewis says this: the real objection is that if man chooses to treat himself as raw material he will be. Not raw material to be manipulated, as he fondly imagined, by himself, but by mere appetite. That is, mere nature in the person of whoever it may be is in control of human affairs, which he calls the dehumanized conditioners. Do you see the point? The point is simply that if values do not correspond to an objective reality which can guide human life, there will be nothing to guide human life but feeling. And what will guide human life will be merely the feelings of those who happen to be in positions of power or control. And if that happens, then human beings will cease to be human beings and turn merely into objects of control and manipulation by whoever happens to be in power, who are in turn governed by their mere appetites and feelings. And that is what Lewis calls the abolition of man. Now, of course, Lewis himself goes on to point out no one can live by this. This view would destroy human relations as we know them. And in fact, We all have to proceed as if the debunked emotions, the debunked values, were in fact objective values. They were still true, they were still there, because we could never tolerate the idea that we were simply being managed by the force of appetite and impulse. Power cannot be what governs human relations on any acceptable view of the matter. Or at least it must be concealed. It cannot be dealt with as such. To use a recently popular term, hierarchy must be presupposed in any context of choice. That simply means there's got to be a judgment about what is better and what is worse, and it cannot be a matter of simply, I like it better, and since I'm in control, this is what we're going to do. Imagine, for example, a committee meeting being run on the principles of the Green Book. Well, you would have a riot pretty soon if it was explicitly done, because I'm sure you've had enough experience with committees to know that everyone wants to be considered, things want to be carefully weighed. It is never to be a matter of simply some person by force of their feelings or whatever getting their own way. This is simply built into the nature of human choice as we know it, and human choice abolished means the abolition of man. So now, as Lewis goes on to say, the attack on the objectivity of values really never is an attack on the objectivity of values in general. It is actually a ploy for the ascendancy of certain values over others. And what are those values? Well, if you read the Green Book and the other pieces of literary criticism that were written at the time, it soon becomes clear, for example, that people want to be scientific. They want to be progressive. That's one of Lewis's favorite terms to talk about, is the desire to be progressive. In the clever book on the Screwtape Letters, he has the master demon Screwtape counseling Wormwood never to raise the issue of truth and reasonable. Rather, ask the question, is the view that we're sponsoring progressive? Is it courageous? And so on. Never raise the issue of truth. He says, when you get on to the ground of truth, you're on the enemy's ground, and there's no telling what will happen then. And so actually what you have in the Green Book is an attempt to sponsor certain values by attacking all values. I'm wondering if you understand what I'm saying there. See, one of the cleverest ways of defending a position is not to have to argue for it at all. And if you're interested in defending a position, you can navigate that. You're in good ground, just to not have to argue for it at all. And so the pretense to be debunking all values disarms the reader so that they don't notice that you're actually sponsoring certain values as undebunkable. And so the values of being progressive, as I say, are one of the values that is used to describe academic work now in my circles, is interesting. And that gains you a lot of ground if you're interesting. And some of the work by postmodernists such as Lyotard in his book on the postmodern condition talks about how things being interesting and creative and so on is the only value that stands up generally in the academic condition of the universities today. And the idea of it being true or of it being valuable in other terms is not considered. Well, I'd like to think just a moment about how far now then this abolition has gone. I've said, as Lewis says, that you can't really live with it, and yet it has gone a long way, as a means of negotiating the processes of government, of culture, and in some cases of education. How far has it gone? Well, I wanted to just tell you a couple of stories from the educational context. One is about Robert Coles. Robert Coles, who is professor of humanities and psychiatry, I think it is, at Harvard, wonderful man, recently published a piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education about the connection between knowledge and character. It was provoked by a young woman from Ohio, where it's rumored that people still believe in the objectivity of values, who had come to Harvard to work her way through. She was partly on scholarship, and she had to work, and she worked by cleaning rooms for other students, and she took courses with the students that she cleaned rooms for. These were courses in moral philosophy, and they talked about being a good person and all that sort of thing. But the students that she served treated her badly. They treated her as if she were a second-class citizen because she had to work. One young man in particular repeatedly propositioned her for sex while she was cleaning his room. And that finally led her come to Professor Coles, who would certainly have not been sympathetic with that, to say she was leaving Harvard. And she raised the question about taking courses, and this young man made A's in the courses. And she raised the question of what is the connection between talking about goodness and being good, rightness and what we ought to do, what is the connection between that and actually being good? And that's where the little piece that Coles wrote got its title, The Connection Between Intellect and Character. You see, if Lewis is right, the outlook of the Green Book simply says there is no connection. That character is a matter of values that are subjective. And you have certain feelings, and they may have certain relationships to your behavior, but it has nothing to do with the intellect. And what Lewis is saying is that if you follow that philosophy out, you become a person with no rational, objective guidance in the kind of person you become and the kinds of things you do. Now, here's this girl sitting in Robert Coles' office, and Robert Coles is a fine man. He has a deep religious commitment. You may make your judgments about it one way or another, but it's a lifelong fact for him. And he's very concerned about morals, not just the theory of morals, but the practice of them. But here she is facing him with the question, what's the point of talking about moral goodness and making A's in moral theory if you do things like this? What's the point? Coles seems genuinely troubled that the only thing he could do for that girl was to shrug. Just to shrug. Now, if you were to ask him, had he ever said in his class, "Thou shalt not proposition your classmate who is cleaning your room"? What do you think he would respond to that? You say, have you ever told your class that? Obviously he didn't. Or was that on the test? Obviously he didn't. Would he have sponsored doing what the young man? Of course he wouldn't have. Now, folks, this is the heart of the whole matter. And I hope you see it clearly. The problem is not the disconnection between intellect and character. The problem is what is or is not in the intellect. And Robert Coles accepts a system according to which you could never say to a class, thou shalt not proposition your classmate who's cleaning your room. You couldn't say that. If he said that, what do you think would be the response of the class? Don't impose your values on us. Okay. Now, you can impose, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. You can do that. If you put that on the test and they say 1537, you mark it wrong. And I'm just trying to characterize as clearly as possible the situation that Lewis said was going to come to pass. And it has come to pass. So a few clever notes about sublimity go to the core of our situation as human beings and educators today. And we can put it very simply, the reason why in general we are flying upside down is precisely because there is nothing that counts as moral knowledge today. Nothing that counts as moral knowledge today. There's nothing you could grade a person on. Apparently today you can't even be morally ignorant. But you could only be morally ignorant if there was something to know. And this situation is one where officially, you see, I understand and I insist, just as Lewis said, you can't really do this. You can't really do it in life. The problem is that if you want to do anything else, you have to treat it as an irrational liking or disliking, and that's all there is to it. Now, I'm running the risk of getting really in trouble, but just to illustrate the situation, and I don't want to offend anyone, but as I was driven into town today, I saw a billboard, and it said, character is cool. Character is cool. That reminds me of efforts to try to get kids to study science by saying, science is fun. And you just think of all the great scientists who did it because it was so much fun. We're really fumbling for motivation when we have to go to that. You see, I don't deny, by the way, that science can be fun. That's not why people become outstanding scientists, to have fun. They don't do that to have fun. I mean, show me one who said, well, I thought it was better than Disneyland. Or something of that sort. They just don't exist. And you show me a person who got a good character because it was cool. You know anyone like that? Well, it was just so cool. Now, cool is big, I know. I know some Christians who think cool is a gift of the Spirit. But I don't think so. I really don't think so. Well, I can tell you more stories about this, but I wanted to come to a conclusion here. We're simply at a point where not a single thing could be taught as moral knowledge. If you were to try to do it, the student would contest it to the dean, and the dean might agree with you, and then it would be contested to the courts, and pretty soon the judge would say to you, now, Professor Willard, we mustn't impose our views. So Lewis's words on page 39, the practical result of education in the spirit of the Green Book must be the destruction of the society which accepts it. Now, for a certain period of time, just the good sense of people will hold the line. But it will not last forever. And as the generations pass, what Lewis is saying, I believe, will come, unfortunately, very true. Well, let me just quickly say a few things about why I don't think this view of the subjectivity of values is true, and then a few words about education. Let's talk about sublimity, okay? That'll simplify it. What I'm saying, I think, will apply to any value, whether it's Mozart and Bruce Springsteen or whatever moral or other value that we might want to talk about. But let's just talk about sublimity. Why should one think that sublimity is an objective property of the waterfall? Now, I don't mean to say one couldn't be wrong about it. Of course, the whole point of saying it's objective is you could be wrong. You might think that a piece of music was elegant and be wrong. But the first reason, I think, why we want to understand that these properties we're talking about this evening are objective is that we experience sublimity or goodness or whatever the value is, we find it in the objective world. Where did you see the sublimity of the waterfall? You saw it on the waterfall. Now, we all know that there are illusions of perception. I'm not questioning that. And illusions are precisely cases where you see things that aren't there. But we can only talk about illusions of perception if we understand that there are veridical perceptions. And when we experience the goodness of a person's character, we do not, as Hume might have said, experience it when we turn our sight into our own bosom and find a feeling of approval. We find the goodness in the person or in the action. We see it to be there. The fact that we do not see it better if we have better glasses, and the fact that there is not a goodness meter that we could hold up to it and measure it, does not mean that it is not where we see it to be in the real world. Now, there's a long story here to be told. I can't go into it tonight. You may wish to get into it in questions in a moment. But that's the first reason, I think, why we should simply say that sublimity is in the real world. And where it is veridically perceived, it is precisely where we see it to be on the waterfall. That moral value is in the action. Aesthetic value is in the art object. And it's only the stripped-down version that comes out of the mathematical theory of nature and tries to say that all there is in the real world are properties that can be mathematically expressed that would lead us to think anything else. Secondly, we should believe that the sublimity is in the waterfall and the goodness in the character or so on, because the nature of the waterfall explains why it is sublime. So, for example, a waterfall that is 2 feet tall cannot be sublime. A waterfall that is a mere dribble cannot be sublime. A waterfall that is, for example, if you had a waterfall off that wall, I'll guarantee you, it would not be sublime, and you wouldn't be tempted to think it was. Because the sublimity of a waterfall requires a certain natural setting. But just the general point now, and that we have to stick to that for the time being, is that the sublimity is really there in the objective world precisely because the nature of the waterfall explains its sublimity. And then the third reason, which I will give, a kind of reason has a long history in these things. We find the objectivity of the value predicate because other appropriately qualified persons under appropriate circumstances know the waterfall or so forth to be sublime. Other qualified purposes. The fact that people who are not qualified to make a judgment, do not appreciate moral goodness, or the elegance of a scientific theory for that matter, or any of the other value predicates that we use, does not mean that they are not there. If other appropriately qualified people do not find it, that's a reason for thinking it isn't there. And if we had time to extend this to cases of sense perception, things like color blindness and so on, we could illustrate that same point there. So we've looked very briefly at the reasons why people might reject the objectivity of value predicates and go the route of the abolition of man. I've tried to give you now just a brief statement of reasons for thinking that values are objective. And I want now to just talk in concluding a few minutes about how to respond in the refashioning of education. And I'm sorry for the presumptive quality of that language. It's too grandiloquent, and what I'm really focusing on here is the specific point about reclaiming the objectivity of values for education.
You collect those questions, and passing among you, you see they're moving about even now, are the purveyors of the pink slip. Don't worry, it has nothing to do with anyone's job. You're safe. But we do have a little card here, which is a response card. It allows you to communicate a little about who you are, where you're from, or what your response to this occasion is, because we always are desirous of having that kind of feedback. I'm going to take just an instant, as folks are passing the cards among you, to make one brief advertisement. It's an advertisement for those with long memories only, because it is just a notice to you that about a year from now, on the 10th of April, 2000, when we are long past any kind of bugs that will keep us from moving through electronic vehicles to get here, we will have the 18th C.S. Lewis lecture, and our lecturer will be poet Lucy Shaw, who lives in Illinois. She is famous not only as a poet, but also as a stylist in the production of the Living Bible and a number of other texts, the Psalms, the Message, the Books of Wisdom. And we'll be very pleased to have her here in a year's time. But now I think we've got our card passers moving along well enough that we will move to the question and answer phase of the evening. And if it works out that you have a good booming voice and you call out your question and it seems like we're all hearing it, then that's fine. Otherwise, I'll ask Dr. Willard to repeat what he's heard so that some who may not have heard will know what the response is to.
If I don't hear your question, I'll just think up one I can answer. And anyone care to make a comment or question? Yes, sir.
The buzzwords today, and certainly in my school, I'm sure here in D.C. also, are diversity,
right,
multiculturalism, toleration, all of which are, in the right context, enormously valuable and good things.
Yes, that's right. Yes, the way you do that, I believe, and the way I try to practice it and where I am, is to precisely refer to this issue of the reasons given for it. If the reasons are given, for example, for diversity, let's say in an educational program, are genuinely focused on the educational advantages that are achieved by diversity. That is to say, if, for example, you have a program in sociology, teaching or research, and it's clear that that program is better as an academic program of research and learning with diversity, then I think that's valid. If it is merely on the general grounds that diversity is something in which people are favorable for, and therefore we ought to support it, it seems to me that that is overriding the fact that diversity is not a self-justifying value, but rather refers to objective conditions that improve values that are objectively recognized. That keeps us precisely off of the path where we're determining policy merely by vague feelings. That gets in also to the issue of what is sacrificed by diversity. I mean, I don't know of... we have trouble over the extreme cases, like Nazis, for example, and so on. It's clear that diversity does not include everything. No one, I think, would agree that diversity includes everything. Certainly it doesn't include exclusiveness. Right? And also, people generally agree that there is a good reason for diversity in some context, and it should be honored. Obviously, if the exclusiveness were based simply on prejudice, that would be a good reason for inserting diversity. So, in general, what we do have to recognize is that the drive for diversity is based on significant considerations, and we have to go into the details. Now, actually, tolerance is a slightly different story. Today, very, very few people want to be tolerated. What used to be fought out in terms of tolerance is now mainly an issue of approval. Tolerance is thought to be presumptuous, because who are you to think there's anything to be tolerated in the first place, right? And that gets us right back into the deep issues about the objectivity of values and so on. And clearly, there's so much that has been wrong, and so much that has been done wrong to others on basis of prejudice and so on, that one can appreciate the sensitivities of people. But on the other hand, we do want to be in a position to say, yes, I do think you're wrong, but I will not kill you for it. I will not exclude you for it. I will not, and so on. Now, if including someone in to a situation destroys the purpose of the situation, and it's a moral purpose, then we have to proceed to look at the reasons for that. So, I mean, you've raised a huge question. I do think that only on the supposition of the objectivity of values any of these discussions make any sense. And so for that, I think Lewis is right on, and that to eliminate objectivity and subjectivity, in favor of subjectivity, and just say with reference to all of these things, it's simply a matter of how you feel, destroys all the issues. But having said that, then one has to go into the details. Thank you. Yes, way in the back.
What is C.S. Lewis's understanding of the nature of man, and what impact does reason have on the nature of man?
Well, Lewis was a great partisan of reason. On the basis of his own Christian understanding, he had a strong view that reason was easily corrupted, so that it was not in itself a sufficient guide to life. But Lewis, in terms of his general outlook, he's what you would call a natural law theorist. That is, he believed that there are certain things that in themselves are good and evil, both in the moral realm and elsewhere. And he believed that these differences were expressed in general form and that these general forms were graspable by reason. In short, if you know this language, Lewis was a fairly standard natural law theorist. And that committed him to the belief that reason was given to human beings by God in order to grasp the necessary connections between things, including between the things that are good and the things that are evil. He thought that reason had the capacity to grasp ends. Makes him very... I think your last lecture here was called The Last Dinosaur, or something. C.S. Lewis, The Last Dinosaur. But to believe that reason has the capacity of grasping ends, that is, good and evil, is very unmodern. That wouldn't have bothered him a moment, of course. The question is whether or not it's true. And he did believe that reason was a faculty of man as a spiritual being for grasping the necessary connections that serve to guide life. Now, in The Abolition of Man, you may know if you've read that, he tries to pull all of the great ethical traditions together, and he uses the Chinese term Dao, not the Dow Jones, but the Dao, T-A-O, to refer, that's very similar to way. It's very similar to the Greek and Christian logos, and also the Hebrew term for Torah, for law. But reason had its capacity, and it had reason was for Lewis something that had to be redeemed, as I've suggested this evening. Lewis was a believer in revelation. He did not think there was a conflict between reason and revelation, that they each had their appropriate places. Yes, someone over here? Yes.
Dr. Willard, would you agree that there's always been a strain within Christianity that has had a low view of reason?
Yes. Yes.
And could you not contemplate or see that strain of Christianity joining with the postmodernists and putting the sword to reason?
Indeed. Indeed. In fact, that has happened, and there are many quarters of theological education today that are welcoming postmodernism as a liberator. The consequences of this are to be seen. You can be for sure that Lewis would have felt very uneasy about all of that. Certainly I feel very uneasy about it. See, to say that reason is corruptible, I've said this evening that reason cannot stand on its own feet. It has to have a moral foundation. And that to me means ultimately a redemptive foundation. But to say that is not to say that it is untrustworthy with reference to everything. The last thing I noticed, the saved and the lost were about equally equipped to balance their checkbooks. And if you just objectively examine the case, you won't notice that the faculty of reason is greater with reference to ordinary affairs. Now, in the guidance of life, there we get in trouble. So that's a very good point. Thank you very much. Anyone else? Yes, over here. Yes.
Don Carson, in his book, The Gang of God, I don't know if you've read that, but he made reference in there to the importance of religious commitment as itself sometimes a prerequisite to some types of epistemological judgment.
Mm-hmm.
To actually being qualified to judge
yes.
the truth of some things.
Right. Yes, I think in any area, just give you a very simple illustration. The capacity to exercise a responsible judgment is very much dependent upon whether or not there is a genuine desire to know. And this applies to all kinds of human relationships especially, and certainly it applies to relationships to issues about religion. Now, you'll notice that when I mentioned the checkbook, I only referred to balancing the checkbook. And there it seems rather close. If you were to look at what the checks are written for, you might get a different account, because then you would see reflected a different value system. So the value system comes in and affects the epistemological judgment. This is not anything peculiarly Christian or modern. This is something that Plato and Aristotle understood very well, with reference to moral matters especially. A person with a corrupt character could not be counted upon to make an accurate moral judgment, or as Aristotle might say, an assessment of the mean. Because their emotions and reason were messed up, they would invariably misjudge the mean, and then they would invariably try to justify their misjudgments of the mean. Into historical theological matters, issues such as the resurrection of Christ, a person who genuinely wants to know, looks into that, they will consider and weigh the evidence in a different way than either one who has decided already it must be true, or one who has decided already it must not be true. And really, I think moral character comes to the fore quickly on the issue of how we approach this issue of wanting to know. We really want to know. For example, if we have a member of our family that is alienated, do we really want to know how they feel about us? If we do, we probably can find out. If we don't, we pretty certainly never will. And we will continue to make bad judgments, miscued by various symbolisms and signs. So I think this is an extremely important point, both at a kind of general level as to what some people call noetic corruption can do to your faculties for knowing generally, as well as for specific kinds of issues. Lewis also was very conscious of these kinds of concerns. Anyone else? I don't want to wear you completely out, but I'm here as long as you want to stay. Yes. Yes.
Kind of thing. With some of the scandals that came out of the United States Army a few years ago in Aberdeen and some of the
right. Right.
The Army has actually launched a training program. In fact, it goes so far as to add a week of basic training.
Yes.
Talking strictly about moral judgments and values.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Remind them of what the Army values are. So what do you think about the idea of training perhaps people like this that some people might say are not so trainable in this area?
Well, I think it's a good idea. The issue is how you do it. And what you're talking about here falls in general in the area of professional ethics. The military actually is one of the recognized professions. And all of the professions, there's absolutely an industry in professional ethics in our country today, and it is precisely because of concerns such as you've mentioned. In this book, The Divine Conspiracy, I tell a story about President Bok of Harvard. I don't want to pick on Harvard tonight. It's a good place. But President Bok, after some of his most illustrious graduates on Wall Street went to jail, decided that the university should think about moral development, and said so in his report to the corporation. I tell that story in this book. The problem is, when you look at these, you begin to realize suddenly they don't have much to do with moral life. What they have to do is with staying out of trouble. Staying out of trouble with the law, with your clients, and with fellow professionals. You will have very little said in any professional code, and I would venture to say nothing in the thing you refer to, about being a good person, about having character. But you know, it isn't the one who doesn't steal who is an honest person. And the thief isn't the one who steals. The person who would steal, if the conditions are right, has the soul of a thief. The question is, how do you get people who wouldn't steal? Not how you keep people from stealing. How do you get people who wouldn't steal? And the problem with moral education generally is that we are not prepared to address this question of character. I know Bill Bennett has sold a million books, several billion of books on it, millions of books on it. But you will find, you'll walk a long mile before you get people to address this question. Even within programs that are often called character counts and things of that sort. We're very touchy about this because this is at the center of our lives. And to address the issue of being a good... Now, see, classical morality only wanted to address that one. Plato's thinking is all directed towards the issue of the restructuring of the inner self so that you can count on it, what the person will do is right. See, Plato had the old problem, how do you rule the rulers? And one proposal is, hand them a list of rules. Plato knew that would not work. Jesus knew that would not work. It doesn't work. You have to train people in such a way that they do not want to do what is wrong. There's a lot of material from our present political and social situation to illustrate that. But I have a feeling you've heard too much about it already, so I won't say anything about it. Yes, sir. When we should stop, just tackle me. Yes.
Could you go ahead and elaborate on your comment that the most significant thing is that which is not seen, and not what we see by the senses?
Right.
That was a good point, and
yeah.
I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Even, for example, things like sets in mathematics, they're not visible entities. As far as I know, no one today would think that the stuff that supposedly makes up the ultimate structure of the material universe is visible. Right? Love is not visible. Integrity is not visible. This gets philosophical, but the unity of an ordinary physical object is not something that is visible. The philosophers have been fighting over this for millennia. God and the soul are thoughts. Logical relations are not visible. In fact, some of you at least will probably know because you've suffered through a few philosophy classes. Philosophers can't even agree on what is visible. Right? What isn't visible? I mean, that's typical of philosophers, and I'm sorry about that. And I don't mean to say it's trivial, because actually there are some very deep issues involved in that, but it's a fact. I mean, you have many philosophers who tell you cannot see a chair. You construct a chair out of stuff you do see, and what you do see is maybe it's in your mind, maybe it's not. But well, that just illustrates. And so Bishop Berkeley, the philosopher, said long ago that the person who has not thought much about God and the soul may possibly make a thriving earthworm, but will never make a citizen or a responsible human being. Yes, sir.
You talked about reason needing to defend,
needing redemption, yes.
Courage.
It has to be defended by moral values.
Is it also get down in final analysis to where, whether one believes there is a personal God who spoke those values into existence or not? Is there a line of defense ultimately short of that that's going to hold up?
Well, this, again, is a deep issue, but let me respond to it as simply and clearly as I know how from what I believe. I don't believe you need to know that there is a God in order to see that a certain person is crooked, or that another person is honest, that a mother cares for her children well. So my answer is, really, I don't think you need reason to see that. I think if you need reason to recognize that someone is an honest person, you're in real trouble. And probably you'll never get out. I believe that there's a lot of things that we know by considering them, just simply by considering them. And in moral matters, I think it is a general as well as a particular intuition of the human mind, that people who care deeply enough about others and themselves to look out after the goods which are important for human life are good people. And that starts at the family level. Basically, it's in the family and in the parent-child relationship and by extension, a sibling relationship and so on, that we really learn moral values. And I think we learn them there because we see them there. Now then later on, we will need to reason about how to put them together. For example, what is there a relationship between compassion and honesty? We're probably going to have to do some thinking about that. And in general, to develop an overall moral view, we will have to use reason. So reason does come into play there, as it does in all that. Reason, by the way, I think, is just simply the capacity of the human mind to grasp necessary connections between things. And there's a long tradition back of that, which doesn't prove it's right, but at least that it ought to be fairly considered. So I don't think we need to get elaborate. Reason comes in later. Not much later, but later. And now, what about in a world where reason has been corrupted? In such a world, if God speaks, we better listen. And it may well be that we should use our reason in part to determine whether or not God is speaking and how and what he says. But there's going to have to be an interplay here between the initiative of God and the response of man. And if indeed it is true that the human soul is irreparably corrupted, we're going to need the initiative of God to get us going in the right direction. New life from above, as some people would say. So we had, as I often say to people, you know, if you believed there was a God, you probably would want to hear him. Because who has better information than he does? And so we need to think about that. Of course, we stand in traditions and in cultures, and these cultures should be speaking to us. This is where virtues like humility and openness and the capacity to listen turn out to be vital for the rational life. Unfortunately, these are often absent from the very centers of reason and research where they're most needed.
Dr. Willis?
Yes, ma'am.
What do you mean by moral tradition? I'm not sure that I understood.
Well, a moral tradition is an enduring set of values that are passed on from generation to generation. Perhaps refined some. For example, if you read the Old and New Testament, you'll see that there is a moral tradition, that certain things are expected of everyone of the community. Sometimes that will change a little bit within the framework of the Old Testament. For example, there is a passage from group responsibility to, as we know the phrase in Ezekiel, the soul that sinneth, it shall die, which I believe is not just a statement about you're surely going to get it if you sin. It's rather a statement that you are not going to get it for someone else's sin. And so there is a some progress of understanding, which I believe is quite clear when you read in that tradition. If you read a Confucian tradition, for example, if you read in that, you'll get a different set of values that have amazing overlaps. And in Lewis's discussion of the Tao, the Abolition of Man was the Riddell Lectures, for I forget exactly what the year was, and when Lewis received the commission to deliver those lectures, he immediately went to work studying all of these traditions, and apparently took the Hastings Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics and just read the whole thing. So you'll find in these various traditions many astonishing similarities, which I think come out of these basic intuitions that we have from family and group life. But they're shaped differently. And especially when they get to the group level, you see very different attitudes. Forgiveness and compassion, for example, are remarkably lacking from many of these traditions and remarkably present in the Christian tradition and coming out of the Old Testament and developing in certain ways until it comes to fullness in the teachings of Christ. So that's what I mean by, and when I say that we are, as a culture, our tradition is a Christian moral tradition. I mean by that, if you'll understand the judgments that, if you look at the judgments that people make about right and wrong, you will see that they derive from that source. It's very interesting. No philosopher has ever yet created a moral tradition. In fact, if you wanted to start a moral tradition, you might find some difficulty with it. They don't pop up every day.
Let's take one more
question. One more question.
Here I see this hand. Yes, gentleman in the blue shirt.
Yes.
I'm interested to know whether you teach your students at SC that propositioning the cleaning help is wrong.
I teach them, but I don't grade them on it. And the reason I don't grade them on it is because the system of which I am a part would not support grading them on it. And that has to be respected. On the other hand, I talk loud and long and say just the same sort of things I'm telling you today. My research is in the area of moral theory currently. I make a huge point. I'm currently running a seminar, a graduate seminar, on the disappearance of moral knowledge. And I apply it to these cases and other cases. No one has any doubt about what I believe on it. I think it's my duty to say that. And now I feel compassion for Bob Coles, because I know the position that he's in. And the only reason I address him is because I think he could have done something different than shrug when that girl said, "What's the point of studying it if there's no connection between the intellect?" You see, he was giving in to the intellectual idol of our age, and he made a mistake on that. And I would never stand still a moment in any context for that. And my saying is, no, the problem with this young man is not that there's no connection between his intellect and his character. The problem is precisely his character is connected with his intellect.